I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. I learned a lot reading A Black Women's History of the United States by Dinah Ramey Berry and Callie Nicole Gross. For instance, in 1600, explorer Isabel de Oliveira was the first black woman to set foot in what would become America, and this was well before the Atlantic slave trade. Belinda Sutton sued the heirs of her enslaver to demand the freedom that she had been promised. And she was not the only enslaved woman to challenge the institution of slavery in court. More recently, Therese Patricia Okomo was arrested after scaling the base of the Statue of Liberty in 2018 to protest President Trump's policy of separating migrant children from their parents seeking asylum. This book is part of the Revisioning American History series by Beacon Press, documenting 400 years of activism by unsung and unknown African-American women, as well as more well-known civil rights champions like Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm. This is our topic for today's Radio Times, and let me introduce our two guests. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Callie Nicole Gross. She is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University. And Callie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas, is Dinah Ramey Berry. She's Professor of History and American History at the University of Texas at Austin, also Associate Dean of the Graduate School. And Dinah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks.
You're very welcome. Let me start with you, Callie, only because we kind of started our conversation before going on the air. You both write in this book that black women's relationship to the United States is both complex and paradoxical. Can you flesh that out for us?
Right. So one of the things that Dinah and I really worked to stress was both the ways that black women had been sort of critical to the development of the country in terms of their labor, their offspring, in sort of enabling the U.S. to amass the kind of wealth that it does to develop. At the same time, we also talk about the hardship and the toll that that extraction takes. So the way that black women are also maligned in terms, at the same time that the U.S. sort of lives off of black women's labors and their offspring, they also are sort of maligned as being immoral, unchaste, and criminal. So that's sort of the nature of the complexity. At the same time, though, you also see how black women manage to cleave out sort of a life for themselves in spite of some incredible obstacles, which I think is a testament to sort of this kind of enduring spirit and legacy, but also it demonstrates sort of the power that they have to collectively organize and to continue to resist and to really demand sort of justice and equality.
I'm curious, Dinah, whether you think we are at an important crossroads here, in that we're beginning to understand some of this history. I was also, as I was reading your book, thinking of Michelle Obama. You know, we've had the first black first lady in this country. How this gets all wrapped up in our history?
Well, one thing I think that Kelly and I wanted to do was to show the larger historical trajectory of people like Michelle Obama and a number of other women that people may have never heard of. And I think because of the media attention on black girls and black womanhood that we've received in the last few years, this book is coming out at a time where we can put all that into context.
I'd like to help make sure that we do understand some of this history. And I mentioned a woman named Isabel de Oliveira. This is back in 1600, and I'll put this to you, Dinah, about helping us understand who she was and what she was doing and what became the United States of America.
She was someone that we were really excited to discover through the work of a few other historians. And then also we did research through some of the travel records of other explorers that were traveling in the same region. Some of that material was written in Spanish, and we had it translated, and we were trying to understand who she was. We learned that she was a woman of Indian and African descent, and this is how she defined herself in the historical record. Her father was Hernando, an African, and her mother was Magdalena, an Indian, as she says. And she filed a petition in Cuartajaro, Mexico, to go on, to have permission to go on an expedition to what is now El Paso, Texas, and New Mexico, in the state of New Mexico today. And she wanted to make sure that no one would bother her because she was a woman of both of mixed ancestry, and she wanted people to know that she was not bound by marriage or slavery. which we think is really, I mean, that just makes me laugh.
That's
every time
pretty bold. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Let me quote her from your book. "I'm going on the expedition," she said in her deposition, "and have reason to fear that I may be annoyed by some individual since I am mulatto." You're nodding your head there, Kelly.
Yes. No, I mean, I think the case is extraordinary because so early on we see this Black woman well aware of her context, the dangers that she faces, but still making this sort of courageous decision to go and be an explorer, but to also go before the courts and to try to, you know, set a course where she herself is allowed to enjoy the freedom. You know, and she ends with, you know, Dinah, you always sort of flesh this out brilliantly. But she ends with this sort of clause that she demands justice, right? She wants to be unmolested and free to travel and to be an explorer in a way that is about her sort of laying claim to a kind of citizenship that we don't even really have clearly defined yet.
Well, as I said in my intro, I learned a lot, including that the first Black women in, again, what became America were not enslaved. These were free women. Dinah, can you speak to that?
Yes, that was important for us to start the book with that because many people, when they encounter African-American history, they think of African-Americans as coming to this country as enslaved people. And we wanted to identify, flesh out that history a little bit more, and also identify that Black people were free before they were enslaved. Right. And that sounds like such a simple complex, but you'd be surprised at how many people have encountered this history in a much different way. You will find, though, enslaved women on ships. We do talk about that. And they appear in the early chapters because we're showing this migration, this movement of Black women, of women of African descent, African captives being brought to what becomes the United States throughout the colonial era and even in the 19th century. And so you're going to be back on and off the ship in the first few chapters as we keep bringing these women that become the first couple generations of African Americans.
In fact, you write that of enslaved people, that it was women and children were really the majority. Is that right, Dinah?
Yes. And Dr. Jennifer Morgan of NYU has published a book that will be coming out shortly that looks at the numbers, because most of the scholars that have written about the transatlantic slave trade overlooked the large presence of women, particularly because they focus mainly on British ships. But when you look at the Spanish and the Portuguese, and we look at all the women that traveled to the New World that were forcibly removed to the New World, we find that women were often in the majority.
I'm jumping around here, but you quote a woman named Nanny Helen Burroughs. I'll put this to you, Callie, where she says, "We specialize in the wholly impossible."
Right. So this is the motto for what would later become the Nanny Helen Burroughs School, where you have Black women. Nanny Helen Burroughs is born sort of just after enslavement has ended and ends up leading the school. And she takes it from, you know, one building on like, you know, sort of a rugged kind of mound of dirt to becoming like this eight, you know, building compound. It's worth over $200,000, you know, the turn of the century. And so it's through sort of their, you know, again, collective organizing, their fierce commitment to educating themselves and to sort of having this sort of audacity to have sort of big dreams and to really kind of seize their time so that, you know, they make the claim, "We specialize in the wholly impossible." Right. Things that they should not have been able to do, they managed to get done.
Well, it's interesting to take that, Dinah, and then go back in history to talk about just the conditions of slave ships, obviously the conditions of life for enslaved people in this country. And there were revolts, for instance, there were mutinies, there was activism even under the sort of yoke of slavery.
Absolutely. Women and men that were captured and young children resisted at every single stage of their captivity. One of the instrumental places where women served was when they were on ships, they were not put in chains. And often brought up to the top deck for exercise or for the enjoyment of the crew. A number of African captive women were raped on slave ships. And while they were raped, they actually were able to see the parts of the ship that others may not have had access to because men were always kept in chains. So women would know the rhythm of when the captain goes to bed or when the sailors are drunk or when they have dinner and where the storeroom is and where the tools are and where the weapons are. And so women were often instrumental in leading rebellions and helping with the mutinies aboard slave ships.
You talked about the enjoyment of the crew. You're talking about being raped.
Yes, and I'm not saying that women were enjoying this.
No,
at
of
all.
Course. I just wanted to make sure that was made clear. Kelly, anything you want to add to that?
No,
in terms of understanding this history.
Oh, I think that it is indicative of sort of the ways that they, again, sort of use anything and anything to try to liberate themselves under incredibly, almost inconceivable kinds of conditions. I mean, when we think about sort of these journeys, you have to deal with sort of rough waters, folks who had never been on ships before a lot of times, under harrowing conditions, they're in filth, you know, people have vomited. I mean, you know, it's horrible to even sort of conceptualize, and this goes on for weeks and weeks. So the fact—
And not knowing where you're
not
going.
Not knowing where you're going, not speaking the language. I mean, so many things, you know, the trauma of being sexually assaulted, but still keeping their wits about them and learning the lay of the land, learning the ships, you know, anything to try to sort of resist.
Yeah.
And that's one of the other sort of themes of the book, too, is sort of activism and resistance. Very early on in African-American women's history, we see sort of the fervent threads of that.
Because of survival, right? I mean, survival either literally or emotionally, soul-wise.
I think definitely to survive, but also I think to really push back. Like, they continue to seek justice. One of the things I'm always amazed by throughout the history is that Black women never stop placing a demand on whatever powers that be for justice. It sometimes, to me, under incredible circumstances, like, you know, I'm blown away by it.
Well, even we're almost up in a break here, but Dinah, even a woman named Belinda Sutton, who essentially went to court to demand her freedom.
Yes, she knew, and this was in 1783. She had two petitions, but one of them was in 1783 to the Massachusetts General Court. After her enslaver passed away, she knew that in his will that she was to be given her freedom and a pension for the rest of her life. And she went to court and had a number of citizens that supported her to file a petition after she had once gone through the transatlantic slave trade at age 12 and lived through enslavement in the United States for a number of years and then filed this petition after her enslaver died. That takes a lot of courage, and it also shows that she understood the bounds of her enslavement.
Yeah, and also a woman named Elizabeth Freeman who did sort of the same thing.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dinah Ramey Berry, who joins us along with Kelly Nicole Gross, and they've co-authored a new book we're talking about. It's called A Black Women's History of the United States. Kelly Nicole Gross is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. And from Austin, Texas, from the studios of KUT, Dinah Ramey Berry is Professor of History and American History at the University of Texas at Austin, also Associate Dean of the Graduate School. You can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Since colonial times, Black women have been shaping America, but their stories have largely been left out of history. We're talking about this new book, A Black Women's History of the United States, with historians Dinah Ramey Berry and Kelly Nicole Gross, celebrating the lives and contributions of Black women who have left their mark on the nation but been overlooked or even forgotten. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. Also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dinah, if I can go back to you, and this is really I don't even know how to put this exactly, but about infanticide and slavery and the kind of impossible, perhaps, choices that were put to Black women, Black enslaved women, when deciding about a child that they had born.
Yes. Infanticide is the academic term that we use to describe taking one's child's life by killing them through a variety of methods. This was a very difficult decision, and I think thinking about it from the perspective of a black woman at the time who was enslaved, one woman claimed that this was a higher form of love. But I always try to tell my students to think about it in terms of what does it mean if the choice to live in slavery or to not live in slavery meant that some women killed their children? It says a lot about the system, a lot about the level of space that women had to make decisions, and the fact that they chose to not have their children experience a life of enslavement.
Yeah, I mean, just a horrifying choice to imagine, Kelly.
Yes.
It is a really horrifying choice. And Dinah and I, we actually spent a lot of time talking about how to write it because we wanted to really sort of display the complexities of sort of enslavement and the brutality of the system so that you have some women forced to make this inconceivable choice, which is to take the life of their offspring. But we also knew that we couldn't sort of leave out the possibility that there were women who, after being brutalized and raped, also did not feel a kinship or connection to these offspring. Mm-hmm. And that this may have been their only way to sort of exercise some control over their own bodies.
I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Sophie's Choice. I mean, it's not exactly the parallel situation, but just having to make this most horrifying choice in one's life.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go completely in the opposite direction. And we are talking about, obviously, the horrors of slavery, but also what African-Americans, and including African-American women, did to fight back. And one was to participate in something called Pinkster Festivals. Dinah, can I start with you, and then Kelly will get you in on this as well.
Sure. These were festivals that mostly occurred in the North. And one of the things we wanted to emphasize that there was also slavery in the North. Mm-hmm. It sounds very simplistic, but that was one of the reasons why we wanted to express that. But Pinkster Festivals were a day for celebration where enslaved people could turn the face on slavery back to their owners and dress up and perform a sort of level of independence and freedom. And we find these festivals happening also in parts of the Caribbean.
Wow. And you write here, where they could mock their enslavers, dress like Europeans, gave political speeches, told stories, participated in festivals involving dance, music, and food. I mean, it just seems like such a strange, Callie, strange aberration.
You know, I think it's a way that they were really able to sort of exercise autonomy and to comment about sort of the hypocrisy of, you know, the lip service that's often paid to democracy and freedom while holding other humans in bondage. So I always think it's sort of a brilliant kind of way that they performed this sort of critique where they knew in other spaces they would not be allowed to do so.
But somehow they were allowed, or they allowed themselves to
exactly.
do this.
Exactly. They find a way to make this, to make that space.
Let's talk a bit, and I did see the Harriet Tubman movie, and so that we know hopefully a little bit more about her. But Dinah, if I can go back to you, that there were other women during the Civil War who fought for the Union, fought against the Confederacy, involved in all sorts of ways of supporting the North.
Absolutely. There are women that went undercover in disguise to help infiltrate both the Confederacy and allow Union forces to know about the movement and the ability of the Confederate troops to make it to different parts of the South. There are also women that are young girls who in their homes made a difference to the history of the Civil War. We opened one of the chapters with the story of a young girl named Mary, mm-hmm. who when the Yankee troops, the Northern troops, came to the plantation to ransack it and quote-unquote free them, right? When they came, the family, the other white women that were on the property, gave Mary all of their possessions, their jewels, their money, and everything, and told her to hide them in her apron. And Mary, we tell the story of this Civil War story through Mary's eyes, and she says when the soldiers came in, they were running with their swords and bayonets, and she said she was very frightened. She was sweating and everything. And they didn't even glance at me a second time. Little did they even think that a slave girl would hold all the possessions that they were looking for.
Which tells you something about the perspective of the North.
Yes.
Do you want to add to that, Kelly?
No, I mean, I was thinking about sort of the original question and also wanting to sort of highlight one of the women that we talk a little bit about is Mary Bowser, who worked as a spy in Jefferson Davis's home. Just because it's another example of the ways that Black women took the lead in sort of helping this war, you know, the war effort to, you know, aid the Union Army in any way that they could to bring enslavement to an end. And, you know, one of my colleagues is working on a book about this, historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar. So we're looking forward to that also.
Yeah,
we're looking forward to that work coming out also. But just to sort of highlight that, again, that you have this sort of continuum of Black women engaged in liberation and this fight for justice throughout American history.
I'm trying to imagine what it'd be like to be a spy, a Black woman spy inside Jefferson Davis's home.
I'm always, you know, I get emotional at certain points. You know, there are points where you write this history where you know, you laugh, you cry, you know, you cheer aloud, and you just sort of marvel at the courage, right, and the strength that these women had to go into these spaces and to endure some of the things that they endured, not just the incredible bravery.
Well, go ahead, Diane. It sounds like you want to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to add that these women, many of these women were already working in the homes of both Confederate and Union slaveholders, you know, and not in Union at this time, but so they were in the space as domestic servants. So they went unnoticed because they were just part of the atmosphere of the home. And so I think that's another reason why they were able to do some of the due diligence, that they could search and find out information and share that information with other enslaved people who then shared that with other military officials. And I think that also just speaks volumes to the invisibility or the erasure of Black women, how people just see them as props in the room and not really as active participants in a historical moment.
And is that something as Black women historians yourself, but also largely talking about Black women's history, have you felt that to some degree as well, Callie, sort of this sense of erasure?
I definitely think there are ways that Black women's history and their experience are silenced. But I usually also focus on the ways that while they are cognizant of that and use that to their advantage, that they never embrace that or accept that as their condition. And so they, you know, they manipulate these things, again, to sort of advance their own cause and agenda, a lot of times to great effect.
And another thing, Donna, that you write about, and this is related to women, I guess, maybe either working for the Union soldiers or for the Union Army, is that they also felt threatened by the soldiers as well. They didn't necessarily feel safe just because they were, you know, surrounded by Union officials.
Exactly. They didn't necessarily, because just because they were from the Union Army, they were still being raped by Union Army officers and members of the military. So they were being raped by people on both sides. And I think that's an important point. And our colleague, Dr. Thalvolia Glimpf at Duke University just came out with a book on women in the Civil War. And she writes about the violence that African-American women experience in these army camps.
There's a word you use, misogynoir. This is violence perpetrated against Black women. I mean, we see a lot of, I mean, this is a thread or a theme in this history, Kelly.
So it's a term that was actually coined by Moya Bailey and Trudez, two folks who really wanted to sort of stress out the intersection between kind of misogyny and also sort of racism and, you know, and also, you know, gender oppression across the board. So misogynoir is this sort of intersection of these two things in the ways that Black women uniquely experience it.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you both. And that's Callie Nicole Gross also joining us, Dinah Ramey Berry. And we're talking about their new book, A Black Women's History of the United States. And again, any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kelly, let me go back to you. And Dinah, I want to hear from you as well, that before emancipation, most lynching victims were white men. But with emancipation came greater lynchings of Black men. Help us understand that better.
Right. And also, too, that Black women were also victims of lynching. So, right, you know, there's a way in which Black bodies during enslavement usually had a numerical value. Right. You could not just go and take a new Black person and lynch them. Right. That was someone's property. There was a cost. If they did commit a crime, it had to be sorted out. Someone had to be compensated. But once you have emancipation and sort of this post kind of emancipation moment where you have the South beginning to rebuild, they once again try to sort of re-enslave Black folks, right? Trumped up charges, arrest people to put them to work. But also, if anyone stepped out of line, they could sort of lynch them now with impunity. They weren't worried about having to compensate anyone. Mm. So this sort of mob justice, you know, sort of reinscribes again kind of white supremacy. And it was something that's ironic because Black men were typically accused of having raped a white woman. And then, you know, were summarily lynched. Usually these were men who were in some sort of, who didn't defer to white supremacy or perhaps ran a business that maybe, you know, was competition for a white business. But on the other side, Black women usually met their end trying to defend themselves against rape. So, you know, the ironies of that mob justice are just, you know, horrifying and shocking to think about.
For Black women in particular. That gets us to Ida B. Wells. Can you speak to her contributions, Diane?
Sure. Ida B. Wells led a major anti-lynching campaign. And I think, you know, in the larger audience, people don't really see that or recognize that. One of the things that we loved about what she did was she created a book. You know, she basically cataloged the lynchings of African Americans in Red Record. And she used the power of the pen and the media to really spread the word about the violence that African Americans were facing. And she used that public space to encourage African Americans to fight against it, but also to put on blast those that were involved in these lynchings.
We're marching through history here. We're moving to now the Harlem Renaissance. So this is obviously after the Civil War. Many African Americans move north to what they hope would be a better life. Why Harlem, Callie?
You know, Harlem is this incredible space. So you have a variety of push-pull factors at work. You know, you have sort of folks returning after World War One. Right. You have this horrendous summer of violence because people object to Black soldiers in uniforms, the Red Summer. You also have the boll weevil, which has been decimating crops in the South. So you have a lot of agricultural workers on the move. And so some of it literally is about the train routes. Right. Depending on where people are migrating from, some of the train routes and the ship lines, these are easiest ways to get to. So you have this massive inward migration from the South into the North, Philadelphia and Harlem. Right. But then also you have this influx of over 100,000 Caribbean immigrants into Harlem. So it's this great sort of thriving community. They are, you know, diasporic and, you know, they're also really invested in cleaving out a space for themselves, not to be constantly referring to whiteness or white supremacy, but to cleave out a society, culture and community for African Americans or Black folks in their own right.
Well, let me play Gladys Bentley. This is a song from 1928. One of the artists, a part of the Harlem Renaissance, and this is her song called Worried Blues.
A major menfolk treat us women like you do. Ooh, la, da, 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 da. A major menfolk treat us women like you do. I, da, 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 da. I don't want no man that I got to give my money to. Ooh, la, da, da, da. Hold me a letter, never nothing but a no. Ooh, la, da, 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 da.
And again, that's Gladys Bentley, a 1928 recording of her song, Worried Blues. Dinah, I want to quote from your book, and this is Langston Hughes describing her, saying, Miss Bentley was an amazing exhibition of musical energy, a large, dark, masculine lady whose feet pounded the floor while her fingers pounded the keyboard, a perfect piece of African sculpture animated by her own rhythm. Can you speak to that?
Well, one of the things that we liked about that quote was that it really reflected the perception that people had of her. And we also have a picture in one of the in the section of the book. We have a photograph of her donned in her white tuxedo. Yeah. So readers will be able to see that. She was a part of a culture of jazz and blues, but she was also a black lesbian and was open in this environment and accepted in this environment in ways that many other women had not been. And Kelly, you might want to add a little more to that, but we really were happy to put her in here.
No, I mean, she's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, she's great. No, just that, right, so once you have that influx of folks in Harlem, it gestates this incredible culture and richness of, you know, literature, art, and music. But it also opens up this space for people to have these expansive sexualities. So you have a vibrant black queer community that develops, and they are talking about a range of issues through sort of jazz and blues. And they are, you know, very much living their lives out loud. It doesn't mean that they didn't encounter homophobia, sure. With, you know, and that there were other kinds of dangers and risks that they faced, but that it was this moment where they were giving their rare sounding to a host of concerns about, you know, sexism, homophobia, misogyny, misogynoir, right?
Well, we found a clip of her on Groucho Marx's show, and she's hilarious.
She's hugely popular also.
Yeah, and played the piano and just kind of gave it right back
very
to her.
Lively. Very lively. And you can tell that from her and her, you know, with her top hat and coattails. I mean, she just had this massive presence. Yeah. You meet some of these people who are just born performers. She clearly was one of them.
Dinah, we're almost up on a break here, but the question, I think it hangs over a lot of these women in this book, is why don't we know more about Gladys Bentley?
I think that has to do with who's writing the history and who they think are people that are important enough to be included. And we have people in this book that we don't know all of their names. You know, yeah. There's women in this book who's, they come to us in a flash and they leave the record. But we still felt like their stories were important to tell. The field of African-American women's history was founded by mostly black women and a sprinkling of white women scholars in the early generation in the 1970s, right at a time after the Civil Rights Movement. And this field is exploding now with scholars, generations of scholars now producing work on biographies, on individual women in all different fields.
Well, let's take that break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Dinah Ramey Berry, Kelly Nicole Gross, our guests on Radio Times today, talking about their new book, A Black Women's History of the United States. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne. We're talking about the stories, the struggles of black women in America, how they have been overlooked by history, how their activism has also changed the country. And again, talking with Dinah Ramey Berry and Kelly Nicole Gross about their new book, A Black Women's History of the United States. Kelly, let me go to you and talk a bit about Aurelia Shines. Help us understand who she was.
Right. So Aurelia Shines was a woman who was born in Alabama in 1919. She married Butler Ben Browder. She raised a family, and she also was one of the black women who actually refused to give up her seat in, 1955 before Rosa Parks. And she was one of a cadre of black women who refused to do so. You have 15-year-old Claudette Colvin also refusing, a young black woman named Mary Louise Smith, and an elderly black woman named Susie McDonald.
Wow.
So all of these women refused to give up their seats before sort of Rosa Parks' historic stand, the one that we you know, most know her for and, you know, gets credited with sort of launching this massive bus boycott.
Well, and not to take anything away from Rosa Parks, Dinah, but it's interesting to know that we know her more than we know these other women.
Yes, one of the things that we were trying to show by highlighting the other women was that this was a very orchestrated and calculated movement that was planned. And Rosa Parks met the criteria for the movement where they felt like she was the right person to put forward. Mm-hmm. And this gets into respectability politics that we were trying to cover and show and flesh out in this book.
Well, and
I just wanted
to add one more thing about it. No, I totally 100% agree with that. At the same time, I think the Aurelia also shows how you have these sort of everyday Black women also kind of protesting just as individuals, and they finally get together and actually form a lawsuit. So Aurelia ends up being the lead plaintiff, right, on Browder versus Gale, where they sue the mayor of Montgomery and the Montgomery Board of Commissioners. So as that boycott is, you know, going on over 381 days, this lawsuit is also wending its way through the courts. And so when they finally win, this effectively helps to end the boycott, that, you know, finally segregation on these buses is not going to be permitted anymore.
But she was an individual who stood up against it. She wasn't in the beginning part of a organized
movement. Right,
a
sort of massive movement. And the thing is, she'd actually, it wasn't the first time that she'd done it. She'd actually refused to get up in 1948. And at that point, she was pregnant. But the bus driver, it happened late on his shift. And so he didn't feel like calling, you know, the police and going through, I guess, the rigmarole, right, for him. He wanted to go home. So as a punishment, he just drove her back to the original bus stop and made her get off.
And walk
home,
so she
had to walk. It was the last bus.
She said, I do not take marching orders from Martin Luther King.
Right, right.
Just to add to
right,
her.
Right. You know, during the course of the trial, some of the attorneys were trying to basically, you know, suggest that, like, these women had been put up to protesting this, you know, by Martin Luther King Jr. She made it clear, like, listen, we don't take our orders from Martin Luther King Jr., right? We are directing him in this.
Mm-hmm. Donnie, you want to add to that?
No, I think it just goes on to, if you look at the historical trajectory that we talked about at the beginning, you're seeing Black women on their own filing suits, right? I mean, this is the same thing we saw with Belinda Sutton and other women in the earlier period. So there's a historical trajectory of Black women standing up for themselves.
Exactly.
Well, let's play Shirley Chisholm. She was the first Black woman elected to the United States Congress. This was in 1968. And then in 1972, she became the first woman and the first Black person to run for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. And here she is making the announcement on her candidacy. The date is January 25th, 1972. I should add that her campaign slogan was Unbought and Unbossed.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America. I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am Black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I am not the candidate of any political bosses or fat cats or special interests. I stand here now without endorsements from many big name politicians or celebrities or any other kind of prop. I do not intend to offer to you the tired and glib cliches which for too long have been accepted part of our political life. I am the candidate of the people of America.
And again, that was Shirley Chisholm announcing that she was running for president of the United States. This is 1972. And Dinah, let me go to you first. She sounds very 2020 listening to that.
Yes, she does. She's also very clear on who she is and how she got there, right? I mean, it's very, very clear. She was one of the things that I think is interesting about her is that she received a number of votes. I mean, she received about 35,000 votes in that campaign and won in November. But she also didn't receive support from people that you would expect her to receive. A number of Black men in the Democratic Party did not support her. The National Organization of Women was sort of on the fence with how they supported her. But the Black Panther Party fully endorsed her.
Wow. Wow. And I was showing Callie, I had the honor of meeting her many, many years ago in my parents' living room of all places. But and you asked me what, you know, my memory was, that she sounded just like that announcement speech.
I'm glad you talked about that. I was going to text Dinah, my total historical geek, that she has a picture of Shirley Chisholm sitting in the living room and they're talking. I know, it's amazing. I know, I was like, would that we had known, right?
Yes, that would have been in the book.
But that's all
exactly.
I know. That's
it would have been in the book.
I was very young.
I mean, she's an incredible figure. I mean, I think she is the, you know, in some respects, the embodiment of that era, right? That grit, that fortitude, right? She clearly is Black and proud. She also is coming very much out of a feminist canon as well, right? You know, she works within sort of the National Black Feminist Organization at one point. But what I think is so incredible about her is that, you know, her run was also about turning on and politicizing other folks, right? Inspiring them to get into politics, to get into this. Like Barbara Lee was mm-hmm. one of the folks who worked on Shirley Chisholm's campaign, right? She encouraged her to go and register to vote, right? So she ran, right, this campaign thinking about how to be a change agent, right? A catalyst for change. It's one of the things that I'm always blown away by, that she says that's how she wants to be remembered, as a woman who was a catalyst for change, right, in the 20th century.
In fact, she says, I don't want to be remembered as the first right. Black woman candidate right. for president.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That what's important for her is to sort of politicize and mobilize people to stand up and be change agents. You don't like how things are run? You think things are unfair and corrupt? Right? Then we got to get in this fight and make real change.
I wonder how she would do in 2020. Something.
No, we could use some Shirley Chisholm energy. That's for sure.
But it is interesting. It reminded me a little bit of Obama when she said, I'm not the candidate of Black America, although I am Black and proud. I mean, she again, it's this inclusive message, Dinah, that she seems to be sending out.
Absolutely. And I've been surprised recently at how many people didn't know about Shirley Chisholm. I've been very surprised by that. There was also another woman that we didn't talk about who ran for the presidency in 1968 for the president of the Communist Party. That's Charlene Mitchell. And she was an African-American woman a few years before Shirley Chisholm. So it just shows the level of activism among Black women to take a stand and a political stand and run for office.
Let me play NASA scientist Katherine Johnson. She actually just died on Sunday at the age of 101. And she was instrumental in NASA doing its space exploration. She was a mathematician. She was also featured in the film Hidden Figures. And here she is on an interview. It's 2011. It's WHRO. It's public television, talking a bit about her life.
I didn't feel the segregation at NASA because everybody there was doing research. You had a mission and you worked on it. Mm-hmm. And it was important to you to do your job and play bridge at lunch. And I didn't feel any segregation. I didn't feel the segregation. I knew it was there, but I didn't feel it.
Kelly, you want to talk about that?
I think it's incredible the ways that, you know, she decided and committed to, I'm here to do this job and I know the segregation's there, but I'm basically going to disallow it to kind of intrude or impede upon my mission. I think that we have a lot of examples of African-American women who decide that once they get an opportunity that they're going to take it and run with it and push past whatever obstacles are there and not be deterred.
Dinah, do you see progress?
Oh, in some areas, yes, but in other areas, I'm cautiously optimistic, primarily because of the ways in which African American are still being treated, not only in the media, but also in politics. There are just stereotypes about Black women that have remained. And what we wanted to make sure that the images that we shared in this book were images that talked against that stereotypical view of misrepresentation that you find among Black women.
And when you talk about the stereotypes, perhaps, Kelly, this is something you talked about early on, about sort of being both the kind of mainstay of the country, but also seen as somehow
right.
other or even criminal.
Definitely. Criminal, extractive, dependent, right? Loud, bossy, right? Immoral. All of these sort of negative images have been sort of bound up in it. But it's interesting at this moment, too, because I was thinking about, since we're on sort of politics, the ways that historically Black women have always been invested in the vote and have politically organized. So Shirley Chisholm is really on this, you know, continuum of Black women who, as soon as they got the franchise, they ran with it, they organized, they, you know, initiated voter registration drives in like the 1920s and 1930s. They actually even worked with a legislator from Massachusetts, George Tinkham, at one point to sort of this ingenious bill. I've been thinking a lot about this, given the current spate of voter suppression, which was they canvassed the South to get testimonies of people who had been impeded from voting. And Tinkham had actually proposed that when congressional reapportionment came around, that it should be done based on the number of votes cast. It's an interesting idea, right? There's this way to sort of push back against voter suppression and the disenfranchisement of African Americans. You have Black women being instrumental in supporting this effort. Now, of course, it was, you know, defeated. But I just sort of highlight that they've always been politically engaged. Even now, it's interesting to see some of the ways that you have these candidates evoking Black women on platforms and as a part of their staff. You know, there's a symbolic thing now that they're using them to try to get that votership, that voting block behind them.
Well, and Donna, you talk about some of these enduring stereotypes, and why have they endured?
Because they've been perpetuated by the media, they've been perpetuated in magazines and newspapers. They're everywhere, and I think that until you have people pushing back against them, like we try to do in this book, they're going to remain unless we speak against that. So that was one of the goals. This series, the book comes in a series. Yeah. None of the other books in the series have images. We refused to write this book unless we could offer images of African-American women in the ways in which they wanted to be represented.
You end with, and I mentioned this in my intro, Therese Patricia, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce her last name, but she was the woman who scaled part of the Statue of Liberty in 2018 to protest the president's policies of separating children at the border. And you say that she embodies Black women's history in the United States.
100%, in part because not only is she sort of brave and courageous enough to take this stance and strike out against this injustice, but also, too, because it highlights one of the other things about Black women's history is that all of the battles that they initiate, they definitely were designed to push back against injustices that Black women faced, but in doing so, they ultimately opened up liberty for everyone else. And in this respect, Patricia Okoma is no different, right? She's scaling these liberty, right, for children from, you know, largely South and Central America who are confined in cages at the border. So it's about liberty and justice for all. And so for me, she was the embodiment of that history. I mean, but Dinah and I both, we knew we wanted to end with her.
You want to add to that, Dinah?
Yes, and I think there's other women that have done this in the most recent years. You know, we think about Bree Newsom, who climbed the flagpole in South Carolina State House, and now there are no Confederate flags hanging there. These are women on the front lines. Maya Little at UNC, who painted on Silent Sam statue. That statue was taken down by protesters. So there are women at the forefront leading movements, whether they're getting credit for it or not. And we wanted to make sure we found ways to highlight them in this book.
Well, we're going to end it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Dinah Ramey Berry, thanks for joining us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's a professor of history and American history at the University of Texas at Austin. She's also the associate dean of the Graduate School. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios, Kelly Nicole Gross. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And she's the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University, and they are the co-authors of this new book, A Black Women's History of the United States. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Also go to Women 100, and that's a series that we are doing here at WHYY in conjunction with Drexel University, looking at women as we mark the 100th anniversary of the right to vote. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we close things out with Gladys Bentley's Quintet 1945 recording, Boogie In My Woogie.
I wonder who's booking my woogie now. Hey, dog, hey, dog, hey, dog. I wonder who's booking. boogin' my woogie now. Hey, da, hey, da. Said the little red rooster, the little white hen, ain't had no lovin' since I don't know when. I wonder who's boogin' my woogie now. Hey, da, hey, da, hey, da. I wonder who's boogin' my woogie now. Hey, da, hey, da. Roses are red and violets are blue. If you take my man, I'll take yours too. I wonder who's boogin' my woogie now. Hey, dog, hey, dog, hey, dog. I wonder who's boogin' my woogie now. Hey, dog, hey, dog.